And good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High with you this morning. And it is now time for Green Side Up here on the Mighty 690. And joining me in studio this morning are David Scrantz and Wendy Powell. Ladies, good morning. How are you doing today?
Good morning. Doing good. How are you?
Doing pretty good. It's good to have you guys here in studio this week. And before we get started on our subjects today, we will, David, you have a couple of programs coming up, correct?
Yeah. One of the ones I wanted to mention is Walk Kansas. Registration just opened for this, and it is a eight-week healthy lifestyle challenge that goes from March 28th through May 22nd, and you can register as a team of six or as an individual. To register, you can go to walkkansas.org or by contacting us at one of our offices. There is a $10 entry fee, but they do have different prizes and a lot of cool stuff going on. So if you're interested, you can check that out.
All right, so that's a program coming up here pretty soon. And, David, we'll go ahead and start with you today. And one of the things you want to talk about is livestock guardian dogs. So just for those of us that are not familiar, what is a livestock guardian dog?
Yes, a livestock guardian dog. Sometimes they're also referred to as an LGD, just to kind of shorten the name, is a type of dog breed that has been bred specifically for the purpose of protecting livestock from predators. These dog breeds have been developed and selected to stay with a group of animals that they protect as a full-time member of the flock or herd. So they've been bred for this specific job.
All right. They basically, like you said, it helps protect from predators like wolves and stuff, or not wolves, but coyotes and stuff.
Yeah, so from coyotes, even domestic dogs that may be running loose, and also in the northern states like Montana and Wyoming, where they do have a problem with wolves, these dogs also help protect flocks from wolves as well.
So, again, protecting those flocks. But, again, some flocks are a little more susceptible than others. And what type of livestock do livestock guarding dogs are usually used with? Who do they usually protect the most?
Sheep and goats are the type of livestock that they are most commonly used with, as sheep and goats are the most susceptible to predation from both wild and domestic animals, like we were talking about before, coyotes, and also domestic dogs that might be running loose. Because with proper instinct and training, livestock guardian dogs can minimize predation on livestock. So they're really a valuable tool for producers, especially sheep and goat producers, because one of their greatest losses comes from predation.
Right. They come in and either take one of them or kill them right there. And again, that's it's sad when that happens, but it's also bad for the farmer or the rancher, because that's costing them money right there.
Yeah, exactly. That's also, of course, it's sad when you lose any animal, mm-hmm. and it's also a financial loss.
Well, how long have livestock guarding dogs been used by livestock owners to protect their herd?
So they've actually been commonly used in other countries for several centuries now. They're a little bit newer here in the U.S. They've only been commonly used here since about the 1970s, and they have become increasingly popular in recent years, especially in those northern states where they're having more problems with wolves recently. And then they've also been doing more research with livestock guardian dogs, especially Texas A&M has been doing a lot of research. They have a livestock guardian dog program down there to really understand more how they work specifically with herds and kind of the range that they travel and how they protect the herds and flocks from predators.
I think the first time I ever saw kind of a watchdog type thing wasn't actually in person. It was on an old Looney Tunes episode where you have the sheepdog watching over the sheep, and the coyote keeps trying to take one of the sheep, but the sheepdog keeps defeating him every time. But then I love they take a lunch break together. And then they come back and start doing it all over again, because, you know, everybody needs a lunch break. So
yeah.
So I remember that back in the day. Well, how do these sheepdogs reduce predation? Because, again, they're definitely a good defense against some of these animals that try to come in and get these sheep and goats and other livestock.
Yeah, well, while other methods such as hunting or trapping that are used to control coyotes are used after the predation has already occurred and you're having problems with, say, a coyote coming in and getting your lambs, guardian dogs can prevent predation before it occurs by deterring predators because they're with the herd at all times. And again, this level of security can save you money and increase peace of mind because they're always there protecting your herd or your flock versus you trying to watch for signs of a predator coming around your herd and then controlling the predator once predation has occurred or you see that direct threat. The dogs, they're constantly deterring predators from even coming close to the herd.
Right. Obviously, you can't be up 24 hours a day.
Exactly. Watching,
so you got to have somebody else help you out there. What are the main ways that these watchdogs reduce predation?
Livestock guardian dogs reduce predation in three major ways. So the first is territorial exclusion, and this is particularly important for protection against coyotes, wolves, foxes, and domestic dogs. So really anything within the canine species. As dogs, whether wild or domestic, use scent to mark the boundaries of their territory. So other dogs or coyotes, even though they might be a different species, will recognize these boundaries and tend to seek unoccupied areas rather risk invading another dog's territory.
Yeah, in other words, they're like, it's like, oh, somebody remarked this. This is their area. I'm going to go find another area.
Yeah, they can smell that there's another dog in there, so they know it's not as easy as a target. And then the next way that a livestock guardian dog deters predators is disruption. So this is kind of the next level. If a coyote or a wolf or domestic dog were to kind of come close to the pasture that herd is in, maybe they're up against the fence line kind of checking it out. They know that the livestock guardian dog's there, but like, let's see how seriously they take their job type of thing. Then the livestock guardian dog will, you know, start barking, letting the predator know that, hey, they're there. And also posturing, which is just kind of like raising their hair, looking bigger, more intimidating.
Baring their teeth.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is all, it's called disruption because it falls just short of physical aggression. So they're kind of like leveling up here. And then the next is, of course, confrontation. So if the coyote, for example, is really hungry, knows the livestock guardian dog's there, hears them barking, but still decides to go for it, that's when the livestock guardian dog will kind of like take action to chase the coyote away, defend the flock. So even with confrontation, it's not necessarily always least lethal to the potential predators. Ultimately, predators avoid protected pastures and keep safely away from herds to avoid being detected or confronted by the livestock guardian dog. But if they have to, these guardian dogs will actually go after the predator themselves to protect the herd.
And like I said, not always lethal to the predator, but if the predator does survive, they probably will not come back at that point because they'll be like, okay, this is protected. I'm not coming back to this.
They know it's not an easy target right anymore, and will keep looking for an easier meal.
Yeah, they'll be like, okay, this is too much work. Let's go find something else. Obviously, since these dogs are protecting this livestock, I'm guessing that livestock guarding dogs, they grow up around sheep and goats, correct?
Yes, they do. And this is one of the main things about the livestock guardian dog breeds, is these breeds have been developed and selected because they live with the sheep and goats. So properly reared livestock guardian dogs are exposed to livestock since birth. A lot of times the puppies will be born in the pasture with the sheep and goats and grow up around the herd. So they don't see livestock as competition, but rather as an extension of their pack, including livestock with their territory, and they prevent losses by discouraging predators because, again, they take real ownership of the territory they grew up in, and they see the sheep or the goats as part of their packs. And effective livestock guardian dogs will bond well with livestock, and they'll travel with the herd and exhibit protective behaviors against intruders and establish areas that predators avoid and remain on the premises. So ideally, they stay in the pasture, but they'll still, if it's a bigger pasture, so the herd might not always be in one area, but they'll move around. If it's a several acre pasture, these livestock guardian dogs will move with the herd to kind of be at the herd at all times.
Because they see themselves as part of the herd, and the herd sees them as part of the herd as well.
Right.
And they become very protective of that herd.
Yeah, and some breeds, they will patrol the perimeter a little bit more than staying in the flock. They'll more patrol around the flock, but they're still staying with the herd, protecting
kind of patrolling the area pretty much.
Yeah, because they take ownership. Just like if my dog, he knows kind of like I belong to him, he belongs to me, so he'll protect me. Livestock guardian dogs look at their sheep or goats in the same way.
I had a cat, I know it's not a dog, but I had a cat that was kind of the same way, that, you know, got her since she was just a little kitten, and she saw me as part of her group and same way, so she always slept on my bed, and anytime somebody came in the room, she would get up and she would walk in front of me just to make sure who it was, and then she would see who it was, and then she would let off, usually my parents or something like that. But she was always real protective of me. So
yeah,
it's cool that animals do that. So what are some livestock guardian dog breeds? There's a few of them out there.
Yeah, there's several out there. The most common breed is the Great Pyrenees. So these are the great, big, fluffy white dogs. And then Anatolian Shepherds, Akabosh, and then I'll probably mispronounce this breed, but it's Marmia or something similar to that is the pronunciation, are the most common breeds of livestock guardian dogs. And these are similar, and these and similar breeds are highly recommended. Breeds that don't have strong protective instincts are less likely to be effective at guarding livestock, and breeds whose instinct is to hunt or herd have behaviors that are counterproductive to guarding livestock. So it's really recommended to get a dog that's a livestock guardian dog breed, whether it's a purebred Great Pyrenees or Anatolian Shepherd, or a cross between two livestock guardian dog breeds, like a Great Pyrenees Akabosh cross. That's fine. What you want to avoid is getting a Great Pyrenees Border Collie cross. Because while Border Collies are a herding breed, they have those herding instincts that aren't really ideal for living with the herd the
right.
whole time.
They want to move everybody around.
Yeah,
because
they
want to
tell
the
herd where to go. So you want to avoid getting a cross that's a livestock guardian dog breed with another breed, because you just don't know which instincts will be stronger in that dog.
Yeah, like, the dog would rather be like, hey, let's move over here, guys, and start trying to herd everybody in one direction. And it's like, that's not what you're supposed to do, man. Depending on how many you have in your herd or pack, how many dogs do you need?
The number of dogs required for optimal protection will, of course, vary kind of depending on the size and number of pastures you have and kind of the number of herd groups. So if you have several different pastures and different herds in those pastures, so say you have does in one pasture and your yearling doe kids in another pasture, then of course you would need two livestock guardian dogs, one with each pasture. But the general recommendation is one dog per 100 does or ewes. This, of course, is if you have a big pasture, you're running a big group of does or ewes. However, it is recommended typically to have two dogs, because if one dog is lost, the animals will still be protected. And then this gives the dogs the option to work together. And even if you do have a coyote or wild dogs come into your flock, one dog can stay with the flock if the other one chases the coyotes away from the flock.
That way, it's they're still protected while the other one is off chasing the other one.
Yeah,
off.
So. Exactly.
All right, well, Davin, lots of good stuff there about livestock guardian dogs. If anybody does have any more questions about this or maybe any other kind of questions for you, how can they get a hold of you?
They can reach me by calling any of our extension offices. I'm usually at the Independence office. That number is 620-331-2690.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Davin. And Wendy Powell is in studio with us. And Wendy, can you just kind of preview what you're going to be talking about the next segment?
We are going to discuss some utter observations. So we'll talk about why it's important to keep notes on that and just some different things to be looking at characteristic-wise.
All right. And we'll have that coming up here in our next segment. We have news coming up here at the top of the hour from Fox and also some local news from Jarrett Sleppy. Keep it locked here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Time to get right back to Greenside up here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. And joining us back in studio are Davin Skrantz and Wendy Powell. And ladies, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Wendy, we're going to go ahead and get started with you. But before we get started on your topic today, you also had a program you'd like to bring up.
Yes. So we are having a sheep and goat meeting. We're calling it Hitting the Targets. That program is going to take place on April 8th, and it's going to be an in-person and a virtual opportunity that will take place at the Research Center in Parsons. So we're going to discuss vaccine handling and some various disease management strategies. So we're going to be talking about hitting the target. That's our theme for the night. So that's an evening program. We do have the information about to be released this week, so be looking for that on social media or call any of our offices to sign up for that. We are planning to have some light refreshments, possibly a light supper. Not sure yet where funding is on that. So be looking for that April 8th in the evening, in person and virtual.
All right, so sounds good. All right, it is time for Wendy as main subject today. And like you said, utter observations. That's what you are wanting to talk about today.
Yes. So it's springtime and a lot of newborns are hitting the ground in all species. So this is something that all producers need to be thinking about regardless of what species they're working with. It just so happens that there happens to be a lot of data on beef cow and dairy cow udders because they're bigger industries right now in our world. But they are these characteristics are very important in all species, sheep, goats, pigs, horses. So this segment is not just for our beef cattle producers.
Right. So getting talk about udders, does the udder size or conformation impact newborns?
Yes, it absolutely does. So newborns, they're not quite sure. They kind of have the instincts of going to the udder after they've hit the ground. But whenever the udder is misshapen, or if the teats are too large for the newborn to get their mouth around, then it poses problems. And that's whenever you're going to have to step in as a producer and maybe have to milk that new dam out and get that udder down to a size that's manageable for the newborn, or take some other precautions to make for sure that mastitis doesn't set in. That's inflammation of the udder, very painful for the new mother, and very dangerous to the udder itself too, because I mean we can talk about the quarter or the half of the udder going blind, which means it's no longer able to produce, but that's a very dangerous situation.
Right. And like you're saying though, to kind of even though if it may be too big for the newborn, it can be made smaller though, can it?
Yes.
Not?
Yes. So whenever a dam gives birth, and if there's problems with the newborn attaching to that udder, you can certainly go in and get that animal up to a set of pins or whatever you need to do and go ahead and milk her out. And that first milk, of course, is going to be colostrum, which is our liquid gold. You want to make for sure that does get into the newborn, but it can be put into that newborn through a bottle or a tube, whatever needs to be done so that animal will be able to suckle.
Absolutely. So are udder characteristics passed on to the next generation?
Yes. Yes, it just so happens that utter conformation is moderately inheritable. That's the term that is mostly used, moderately inheritable, which simply means that it's not low inherited, but it's certainly not one of the higher characteristics among the traits that's inherited. But you certainly do want to keep track of any dams that have underperforming udders or unfavorable udders in any manner, because in all species it's moderately inheritable. So that's just going to be passed down from generation to generation. I had a cow that had a halfway decent udder, and she had twins, and I kept both of those twins, and oh boy, those twins had terrible udders, and I kept a daughter out of one of those twins, and it just kept getting worse. So finally I had to get I had to call that whole line, and it gets to be disappointing whenever the only characteristic is the udder that's disappointing in an animal. But at the same time, if this is a dam that's expected to raise her newborn and she can't milk, or if the newborn can't nurse, then it's kind of defeating the whole entire purpose.
Right. You got to be able to nurse, got to be able to feed, because otherwise it's like you said, it's going to defeat the purpose and it's not going to be good.
Exactly.
All right. So what sort of records should producers keep to track this type of information on all this stuff?
Sure. Any notes that you're able to make in your production record books. We had a production record keeping class a couple of weeks ago. Any notes that you can keep on either excellent udders that you want to make for sure that you are passing those traits on through the next generation, or really terrible udders. You want to make those notes. And there's not a set system of like a number of 1 through 10. 10 is good, 1 is bad. There's nothing like that, but you can create something for your herd if that would be helpful to you. But you certainly need to be tracking what's going on. And the best time to be doing this is right before the dam freshens, which simply means she's about to give birth. That's when you're going to see the udder swell the most, with getting that colostrum ready. And then whenever she gives birth, that newborn's looking for the udder, just making those observations of what you're seeing, so that next year, if this year, if you see that cow is struggling, next year you need to maybe go ahead and get her up to the pens, so that you're on top of that game. With udder conformation, we can talk a little bit about what to look for. Teat size is certainly important. Whenever animals are getting trying to find that milk, they need to have a teat size that's able to go into their mouth. So with sheep and goats, that's quite a bit smaller than with cows, but it still matters. You don't want them, for cattle, you want about 3 inches, and then you want all 4 teats to be about the same size. So you're not looking for, the calf's not looking for one really small one or one really big one. They're familiar with all four quarters.
Because
already,
usually they'll just walk up and just grasp the first one that's there. And so they all should be around the same size.
Exactly. Yes. And with all species, of course, you want that udder floor to be fairly level. Of course, your sheep and goats only have halves, they have udder halves, and cattle have quarters, but you want that to be fairly even. You want the teat size to be even. You want the ligaments between the quarters or the halves, we call that the suspensory ligament, the ligament that goes from the tail to the nose of the cow that holds the udder up. That's the suspensory ligament. We'd need that to be pretty strong, so that as the animal ages, then the udder is going to stay suspended well. Because, you know, as cows age, as goats age, the udder is going to fall a little bit. And when it gets below their hocks, then it can be pretty painful for an animal to stand up if they accidentally step on one of their teats.
Right.
I can't even imagine that sort of pain. So that's something to be looking at right there. And then, of course, you want to look at the attachments. So you want the 4 udder attachments to be smooth with the belly. That's where all of the mammary veins are going to be going, carrying the blood to the udder to make for sure that we've got good milk production. You want those veins to be, of course, on the lower part of the belly so that it's more exposed to the udder. And in the rear, the udder attachments needs to be high and tight, we call it, closer to the tail head rather than closer to the hocks. So those attachments need to be really strong. And that's something that you can look for as your animals age, how that progresses and how that udder ends up breaking down. And that's why whenever we're looking at cattle, usually they're productive life starts to decrease about 7 or 8 years old. And that's really when the udder starts to be decreasing in its productivity. So if you do have situations that the animals had mastitis or other problems where the udder, the quarter or the half is blind, you can still supplement calves or other newborns. But it's really important to monitor that, and so you know what's going on.
All right. Well, Wendy, we have somebody calling up here. We're just going to make sure that they're not calling for open line. But caller, you're on Green Side Up. Good morning. How are you doing today?
Okay, I'm doing okay.
Are you calling for open line, or are you calling for Green Side Up?
I'm calling for open line.
Okay, open line is not started yet.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so I was just making sure because usually people call for open. This is around the same time, so
gotcha. Gotcha.
All right. So again, some good stuff there, though, Wendy. And if anybody has any questions about udder observations, how can they get a hold of you? And also, not just that, lots of other things. If they have any questions, how can they get a hold of you?
Sure, I'm usually at the Altamont Extension office. That phone number is 620-784-5337, but we do have offices in Girard and Fredonia as well. David mentioned the Independence office on the earlier segment. But we also wanted to announce, Kyle, that we have started a new endeavor. Each Monday or Tuesday before our radio show with you, we are trying to put together a graphic of our pretty little faces as well as the topic that we're going to talk about for the day. So if folks want to check out our Wildcat District Facebook page, Instagram, Twitter, I don't know what all of our handles are, but we're easily found. We're going to be posting our topics, and so folks can go ahead and post questions if they'd like, or please do share that. We're going to be posting the time and date of all of those things, so feel free to share that. I do encourage folks, if they do want to comment with a question or a topic suggestion, then they need to preferably comment on the original post so that we can see that. You know how when things get shared, they can kind of get lost in the shuffle.
Right. So if you have a question, and you guys will answer it here on the show, but again, be sure, I guess you can just search K-State Extension and you'll probably be able to find it pretty well on Facebook. And also, don't forget, after that, we have our shows that we do post on our website that you'll be able to listen. If you missed any part of today's show, you'll be able to listen to it a little bit later as well.
Yes, and I do have one more thing to announce. We just heard yesterday that the COVID vaccination is going to be available to farmers and ranchers. And that's going to be, I'm trying to pull up the message right now so that I can get this all correct. So farmers and ranchers qualify for a no cost vaccine under phase two, and they can stop by our office in Altamont, Girard, or Independence to sign up for a block of vaccines since we have registered with, I'm not sure what CHC-SEK stands for.
Community Health Center of Southeast Kansas.
Well, there we go. So. Way to be a team player.
We've done a lot of stories on them, so talking about the vaccines. So yeah, that's the only reason I know that. So
great. So those vaccines will be administered the week of March 22nd, but you do have to pre-register. So that any farmer and rancher in our counties or across state lines, they can sign up through our offices to get their vaccine if they're interested.
All right. Good stuff. Ladies, thank you so much for coming in today. We really do appreciate it. And again, if you missed any part of this show, we'll have it up on our website in a little bit. It'll be under the interviews section in the community section. So be able to check that out if you missed any part of the show today. Ladies, thank you again so much for coming in. in today. We really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take a break. And when we come back, we will have Charles Skank with the Midweek Medicare segment. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.